That was a portion of Miner's Child from violinist Regina Carter's 2014 album Southern Comfort. Regina Carter is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to episode 22 of the Burning Ambulance podcast. If this is your first time listening to the show, welcome. And if you've been with us for a while, welcome back. The Burning Ambulance podcast is part of the OSIRIS podcast network, which has over 24 shows on a broad range of subjects, including music, parenthood, craft brewing, writing, comedy, and more. So visit osirispod.com and check out the whole list. I'm sure you'll find something that will appeal to you. This show is available on iTunes, for Android, on Stitcher, and probably every other place people find podcasts, so I hope you'll give us a star rating or a review on iTunes, and if you want to help us continue to produce future episodes, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/burningambulance. Regina Carter is one of the best-known jazz violinists in the world. She's originally from Detroit, and she got her start in a kind of smooth jazz group called Straight Ahead. From there, she moved to New York, joined the String Trio of New York with guitarist James Emery and bassist John Lindbergh, and also started making solo records starting in 1995. She's made 10 albums in all, including one that was a duo with pianist Kenny Barron. And of course, she's worked with all kinds of people, including Wynton Marsalis, Cassandra Wilson, Oliver Lake, Madeline Peyrou, Steve Turi, Terry Lynn Carrington, and James Carter, who's also her cousin. She won a MacArthur Fellowship in 2006, which has allowed her to work on some really interesting projects. Southern Comfort was an album that explored Appalachian and Southern roots music as a way of tracing her own family's history. And her latest album, Accentuate the Positive, which came out last year, was a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald, but it doesn't feature the songs you'd expect. A lot of the pieces are obscure, and as a consequence, she doesn't really feel the need to perform them in a way that the listener might immediately identify with Ella Fitzgerald. I met up with Regina Carter at NJPAC's all-female jazz residency, a week-long program for students from 14 to 25 in Newark, New Jersey. She was the artistic director, taking over from Jerry Allen, who founded the program, but who passed away suddenly a little over a year ago in June 2017. The residency combines lectures and seminars with rehearsals and masterclasses so that the women who are taking part learn from each other as well as from people who are already making careers in jazz. And as we talk about in this interview, it goes beyond music. They also learn about branding yourself and maintaining a social media presence, about what radio expects from an artist and how to make an impression on journalists and DJs, and other things that will allow them to become professionals and avoid pitfalls in their careers. I had originally planned for this to be a joint interview with Regina Carter, saxophonist Tia Fuller, and drummer Terry Lynn Carrington, but it wound up just being a conversation with Ms. Carter. Nonetheless, I think it's really interesting, and she's got a lot to say not only about her music, but about the residency and about the state of the jazz business, so I hope you'll enjoy it. I'm going to play one more piece of music. This is the first section of I'll Chase the Blues Away from her album Accentuate the Positive, and after that you'll hear my conversation with Regina Carter. Thank you. So, your new record is a collection of songs associated with Ella Fitzgerald. So, how did you choose the tracks for the record? What was your criteria?
Well, because it was Ella's 100th birthday, I knew many musicians who would probably do tribute records to her, because so many, we all love Ella, you know. And I didn't want to do, almost on every record I've recorded that's been a traditional or a jazz record, I've done one or two tunes of Ella's. And so I didn't want to do the typical tunes that everyone thinks of when they think of Ella. And I was list going through, you know, listening to the box set and finding all kinds of other recordings. And I started finding tunes I had never heard before that I found to be really interesting. And with this record, with Accentuate the Positive, I wanted, I had many different people write arrangements for the tunes, but I didn't want them to be in a traditional straight-ahead fashion. I didn't want to do them just as she had done them. And I felt that I would have permission, so to speak, from her to take liberties with these pieces, because Ella was one that sang everything from bebop to doo-wop, country, western, everything. She just loved music. So I felt like I would have her permission. And I felt doing tunes that were lesser known tunes or tunes that people had maybe forgotten about, I could take more liberties with those tunes than tunes that, you know, everyone knows.
And what are the sort of challenges of reworking songs that are identified strongly with a vocalist as an instrumentalist? You know, obviously, what do you have to do? Because sometimes, you know, a track may be relatively sketchy and just intended to set up a vocal. So, you know, what do you do with it?
If it's a very well-known tune, you're saying? Well, first of all, any vocal tune, I have to learn the words. So I have to know what it is, because I'm singing inside and it's coming through my instrument. And I want people to feel like they can hear the words when I play them. That's important for me. So, you know, when I've recorded more of her well-known tunes, I've pretty much kept them as they are. Maybe I've just added on to the arrangement, added a tag or added something in the bridge. Like when I recorded Tisket a couple of records ago, and the band, along with John Clayton, came up with a really nice arrangement around the tune. But I didn't really do anything different with the melody. I kept that pretty much the same. I feel like I could take more liberties with a lesser-known tune.
And before this album, your one from 2014 was Southern Comfort, which was a collection that had a lot of traditional songs and then a couple of country songs from the 50s and 60s. But you're not from the South, you're from Detroit. So what was your connection to that material? What were you exploring there?
Oh, well, what do you say, Detroit and Chicago, that's up south. I was tracing my father's side of the family. I know very well my mother's side, her history, her family's history, but I didn't know, my grandfather passed away before I was born on my father's side. And when I would try and find out information about him from my uncles or my aunts, they would say they didn't remember him. And I thought, how could you not remember your own father? So that meant there was something there. So it made me even more curious, who is this person? And so, you know, no one was giving up any information, and one aunt has the family Bible with all the information, but she won't part with it till, you know, we won't get it till she dies. So I just had to go with, I joined ancestry.com, and I started finding out, you know, finding other relatives, and I would take information from their family tree and get more information. He was born, I believe it was in 1893, and I knew he was a coal miner. He and my grandmother had 14 children. And so I went, my way of trying to get to know him was to musically go to that period and say, what was the music like during his lifetime while he was growing up, and try and trace that. And so finding field recordings of mainly just voices of pieces, whether they were work songs or songs that from an all-girls school or an all-boys school, you know, games, lullabies. And what was interesting about some of these pieces, you know, because he came from Alabama and from the Appalachia area. And so you have a mixture of African Americans, Native Americans, the Scots, the Irish, all these people there living together. And their music and their cultures are all influencing each other. And so some of these tunes, there was one piece, it was just a single voice, Cornbread Crumbled and Gravy. And so I recorded that with guitar and bass, and we came up with an arrangement for that. And I played it one night at a club, and there were some people there from Finland who said they recognized the tune, completely different words though to it. So no matter where I would go, people would recognize that. So, you know, it's just showing me again how much we're all connected. So that record for me helped me get to know my grandfather.
Yeah, I did the same thing on Ancestry some time ago, and I was able to get back four generations, I think it was, because my great great grandfather came here from Sweden in the late 1800s when a whole bunch of people came over. But the thing is, when he came from Sweden, he changed his name from Johnson to Freeman because he says, I'm a free man, I'm done with my whole family in Sweden.
Wow, yeah.
And so that's where the line ends as far as I know. Wow. Because, you know, if I try and go back through Swedish birth records, it becomes a whole other thing.
Right, right, wow. But at least you could go that far back. That's pretty huge.
Yeah. I told Cecil Taylor that story once a couple years ago, and he was horrified that anyone would cut off their roots in such a way, like, because he was somebody that was just hugely into his own lineage and stuff like that. You know, I don't know if you ever met him or, you know, spoke with him, but
I met him but never had a chance to have a conversation.
Yeah, he was very big on that, like tracing his own history, and, you know, knew everything there was to know about his family and stuff. And so I told him that, and he pretty much gasped out loud.
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of people, even I think about my own family, that they don't want to talk about things, and a lot of records were burned and things. They just didn't want to have that memory, which for me is horrible. They couldn't think that far ahead how it was going to affect, you know, me and future generations, that we need that information. We need to know. But yeah, that's people just, nope, going to forget that part of my life.
Yeah, yeah. Done with all of you. So both of those two albums had Marvin Sewell on guitar and Chris Lightcap on bass. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if, you know, it allows you to do sort of a string band thing within a jazz context, which would also fit with the sort of rural music that you were doing on Southern Comfort.
Yeah, it did. You know, there are certain tunes where it was just the bass and the guitar and violin. And I actually did a tour of that grouping. And there are a lot of famous trios like that. And I always think of Jean-Luc Ponty's string trio. But that instrumentation really lent itself to the type of music, those field recordings that I re-recorded. But I had a full band. I had Will Holthauser also on accordion and Alvester Garnett on drums. So we could do much more with the arrangements as well. But within a set, I could have all these different colors.
Yeah, yeah. And there is sort of a whole black string band tradition, mm-hmm, with that instrumentation. Mm-hmm. There was a group in New York a few years ago. I think they were just called the Black Hillbillies or something. Mm-hmm. And I used to see them play in Penn Station. And it was guitar, violin, and upright bass. Three old dudes.
Wow.
And they were, you know, straight hillbilly music.
Wow.
You know, it was really, really something.
Yeah, I had a chance. I was artist in residence for San Francisco Jazz when they first opened, and I brought in Rhiannon Giddens and the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
Right.
And they're so amazing, and the music that they're doing. And I remember it was interesting because I had just recorded Southern Comfort as well. And we were just talking about tracing music, and in doing so, finding recordings of really racist recordings and just being mortified by it, but realizing, okay, you can't bury that history. That's part of American history. And when we try to bury it and not deal with it, that's why we have these issues we have today, because people don't want to deal with it. But oh, I had a point, I just lost it. But anyway, it was just amazing to hear what they were doing and to hear even another, because she does a lot of, I think it's, is it the Irish or Scottish? Maybe it's Scottish influence in there. I think in the music, but it was really beautiful, just that the arrangements that they were doing and some of the music that they found. And we both, there was I can't remember this woman's name, but we both the tune is Another Man Than Gone. Mm-hmm. So we both had come across this piece and worked with it.
Yeah You did that one on which album? Was it Reverse Thread?
No, I actually re-recorded it and we didn't put it on the record for Southern Comfort.
Okay. You did not start on violin, you started on piano, right?
Right.
So what was your sort of musical arc? How did you get to violin?
Well, I started on piano when I was 2, by mistake, because I walked up when my brothers were having their lesson one day, and they said I walked up and started playing a piece that they had been practicing. And they were shocked, and their teacher said, "Who taught her how to play?" And they said, "No one, we didn't know she could play." So she tested me and found out I had a gift to be able to play back whatever I heard. So she recommended a woman that was used to teaching children, and I would go into my lesson, but instead of learning the pieces in the book, I'd go in and say, "This is my song I wrote." And I'd take the crayons on that big green paper where you learn how to write your alphabet, and I would draw these big eggs, and I'd say, "Here's my song." And that woman, Anna Love, didn't want to stifle my creativity, so she told my mom, "Just let her keep composing at home, and when she's older, we'll try it again." She kept all those papers and made a book for me when I graduated from high school. But
graphic score.
Yeah. You know, it's like, who needs the computer, you know? Who needs Finale? So when I was 4, the Suzuki Method for Strings was being offered for the first time in Detroit. And this woman called my mom and said, "I think this would be great for her because you learn to play by ear first. It's the same way you learn how to speak, by imitating." And so the teacher, I guess, just handed people instruments. I got the violin. And maybe a year after I'd been playing, she gave us all an opportunity to walk around the room and try all the other stringed instruments. And I came right back to the violin.
And so the Suzuki Method, you said it works by ear training first. So, and then just give me like a capsule of it, because I don't really do anything.
Okay, so how it's supposed to happen and how it happened for me are totally two different things. So because my ear was so strong, my teacher waited too long to try and teach me how to read. So by the time she'd teach me how to read, I would play a song and my ear could hear where it was going. I might not play the right note, but I would play a melody that was in the right key. And so it made reading more difficult, but you start to learn how to read and to identify the notes that you're already hearing. And then you have rhythms, you learn rhythms by putting words and phrases to them. And so when you have an eighth note to 2/16th notes, I went bum, ba da bum, ba da bum. It'll be hot chili, if you turn it around, chili dog, 4/16th is motorcycle. Then a dotted eighth to a 16th is new, canoe, 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 and then hot dog, motorcycle, hot dog, chili dog, motorcycle, cantaloupe, and watermelon, one, rest. So even now, I'm reading a concerto or something, that's how I count it, because I don't feel like sitting there one E and a two. It's just, it makes it a lot easier for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a great way for children, because it doesn't feel like learning.
Right. Yeah, I took violin in 3rd grade and never picked it up. And now there's a trumpet in my house, and I can, if I really try, I can get it to make the same noise twice.
Right.
That's about it, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And
it's harder when you get older.
Yeah, yeah. I met Ornette on the street one time, and he asked me if I played anything, and I said to him, I said, you know, I play the trumpet a little, but I kind of had to give it up because I'd been writing since I was 12, you know, and that I knew that was my path, you know. And what he said to me is, he says, "You should stick with it because you can make the same mistakes either way."
I like that.
So you started out professionally kind of as a member of this group Straight Ahead, in the early 90s.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Did two records with them, and then you left before the third record.
Right.
So what was going on? Were you thinking you were going to go solo, or were the dynamics of the group not what you were interested in, or what kind of happened?
I before I joined Straight Ahead, after I graduated from college, I went to Germany for vacation and stayed 2 years. Came back home, and I planned on moving directly to New York. Well, I didn't have the funds, so I had to work. And Galen McKinney, the drummer, called me up and said, do you want to, you know, we have this all-women's band, do you want to be a part of it? And I said, sure, but I'm only staying in town a year. I'm moving to New York. It took me 2 years to leave. But so I was in the band with Galen McKinney on drums, Marion Hayden on bass, and it's interesting because Marion's mother and my mother had known each other since they were 13. So we came up together in the same church. And then there was a woman, Mickey Braden, actually, who had started the band. So it was Mickey Braden, a straight ahead vocalist, Eileen Orr on piano. And then when Mickey left and moved to New York first, then we had another vocalist, Cynthia Dewberry. The Detroit Jazz Festival used to be called the Montreux Detroit Jazz Festival. So they sent us to Montreux 1 year to play, and a group from Montreux came to Detroit. And someone in Montreux heard us rehearsing, and we were going to play in the club there. They asked if we wanted to open up for Nina Simone and Ofra Haza. It was Women's Night, and we were like, yeah. So we only had like a short time. We came up with an arrangement. It was a five-camera shoot or more. Got this great video. There's a woman that just passed away in Detroit, a huge part of Motown. Her name was Sylvia Moy. Mm-hmm. And she co-wrote My Sharia Moore and a bunch of other tunes with Stevie. She got a hold of we gave her the tape. She sent it to Atlantic and got us signed to Atlantic. So we did two records. Lenny White produced those first two records. So finally, I had the opportunity to move to New York. I actually moved right before we recorded the first album. So I was still going back and forth and playing with Straight Ahead and touring with them. But, you know, I needed to start to try and make some connections in New York and really get planted there. So probably during the first year there, this group, the String Trio of New York, called and asked if I wanted to sub for Charles Burnham, who was doing a play. And the interesting thing is how they got my name. Before I moved to New York, my brother right over me got married in New York. Both my brothers lived in New York before me. And he hired a jazz band for his wedding. So the band was playing for the reception, and I asked if I could sit in, and they said begrudgingly, okay, but you know, I'm the groom's sister, they had to say yes. So I sat in, and the saxophonist was like, wow, give me your number, you know, are you gonna move to New York? And I said, yeah. He goes, make sure you stay in touch with me. It was Marty Ehrlich. So Marty actually gave them my name, the String Trio of New York. That's how I got that gig.
Wow.
Yeah, so you never know.
Yeah, yeah. So then you did a couple more records for Atlantic and then moved to Verve.
Right.
And it seems like the Verve records cover more ground stylistically than the Atlantic records do. Was that a condition of the label, or did you start to have like bolder ideas over time, or, you know, was it a combination of both things? What
I think when I recorded my records for Atlantic, I wrote most of the material on both of those records, and they call them smooth jazz records. Victor Bailey, the late Victor Bailey, produced the first one, and Arif Mardin produced the second record. When I went to Verve, it was after I had done the tour of Blood on the Fields with Wynton, so they were looking at me as a straight ahead artist, and they didn't want any of the stuff that type of music that I was doing for Atlantic. Mm-hmm. So then I didn't write in a straight ahead vein. So I started picking standards that I liked, but the material that I picked was kind of all over the place because, you know, those are my influences growing up in Detroit. You know, Detroit had a very serious jazz scene, but we also, you know, it's a very mixed culturally mixed city. So I grew up hearing music from we have the largest Chaldean community in Detroit. You know, I have friends from Greece, and I go in their homes and you hear this classical music from all these other countries. So I'm hearing all this music Motown. I'm a big Motown baby. I love that music. So all of that is in the pot, and I wanted to represent that. And I wasn't thinking, okay, this is my Motown tune, and this is my this tune. It was just, these are my favorite songs. Mm-hmm. And the first record, I remember my A&R guy said, well, this record's all over the map. It's going to be hard for people to sell. And I was like, no, we have to figure out a way, because this is who I am. So then, you know, he thought about it. And he goes, well, maybe call the record Rhythms of the Heart, because they need a story. And mm-hmm. then that's just, we're saying that the record is just all the rhythms that I like. So, and I learned to start thinking like that, like, you know, making the record have a theme mm-hmm. so that there could be a story.
Right, like there was the Detroit record from right. 2000, I think.
Right, Motor yeah. City Moments, right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, does that, so how do you put together a record? Like when you, do you pick a bunch of tunes and eventually say, okay, I have enough for an album? Or do you say, no, it's time to make an album, let's find some tunes? Like what is, you know, how do you kind of approach?
It's I have to make a record, and then I start thinking, what is it that I want to do? And I make myself crazy, because then I think, okay, I'm going to do this. And I start researching, and then I see something interesting over here, and I go in that direction. And then I say, oh my God, look at all this over here. It's just like, you know, all over the place. But I kind of don't rein myself in, because where I start is not usually where I end up, but where I end up, I think, is much more interesting than the first idea that I had. And then once I start researching, and I like to read and research and go listen and, you know, interview people, get suggestions. And I spend, you know, one of those records, I think I spent 2 years almost researching and collecting material. Then I start to get arrangements done and playing with the band. Sometimes a tune I might like doesn't work for me on my instrument, or the arrangement, and then I try the arrangements and keep tweaking them and tweaking them. And then, you know, finally it comes together, and I like to play the tunes a lot with the band, so that by the time we go in the studio, they've had a chance to simmer and the seasoning is in there, you know. And so, and then I like with, was it Reverse Thread, I recorded the whole record in one room. I wanted to do it like they used to do back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to do that because those studios don't exist anymore.
They were, right, those, the big rooms, you know, are all gone.
Yeah. And so, but I like to take my time. And I can, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to have that luxury to take my time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you've done, like we said earlier, you've done two records with more or less the same band. So what do you, and you've been using Lightcap longer than that, like he's been around for a while.
Lightcap and Alvester Gynette have probably been the two longest members in the band on and off, and sometimes I switch up musicians, but those two have been with me the longest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what, you know, what do you get from Chris, like from the violin to the bass, like what, you know, what does he give you to feed off of that, you know? Makes the creative relationship work.
Well, it's not even just about him or the, it is about him. He's got a sound that I really love, but it's really the rhythm section. Like, you know, when Alvester was in the band and I had a different bass player and I had a different piano player. So when I was looking for a bass player, I asked them who they felt more comfortable, the pianist and the drummer, who they felt more comfortable playing with. Because if that unit is not solid, then the rest of it is not going to work. So I really dug Chris. I thought he had a really big sound. Plus, he's very familiar with other music, like very into African music, West African music. Rhythmically, I like that. A free player. I just like the way he's not boxed in.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Alvester, and now I have Xavier Davis on piano. So that's just a solid foundation. And when they're there, I can ride on top. Once I find people that I'm comfortable with, then I want to stick with that, you know, because, you know, we used to spend a lot of time on the road together, and I want to be comfortable on the road. I don't want any issues, no drama. So it's they're family.
Yeah. And now your current record deal, you're on Sony through OK.
Right.
Right. So In 2018, does a label carry any weight from a branding or marketing perspective, do you think? I mean, what, you know?
Not with me. Maybe with a new artist, they might, you know. But, you know, they have to work on that with a newer artist. I license my records to them. I've been licensing records since to labels probably since I got a MacArthur award in 2006. And I was off of Verve. So I took my time recording Southern Comfort, and it took us a couple of years to find a label. I said the label had to take it as is. And it was Chuck Mitchell. He wasn't at Sony yet. I believe he was still at was it Heads Up? No, he was at E1.
Yeah, because you did Reverse Thread for them.
Right. So, and then when he left E1 and went to Sony, he took me with him. And Chuck would come into the studio and listen to what I, and he'd say, this is your baby, this is your music, I can't tell you what to do. He might make a suggestion, maybe change the order or think about this, but he would never, which I really respected. And so he took me to Sony, and Sony Masterworks put out Southern Comfort. And then with this last record, Ella, it was Sony OK, but Chuck is gone now. So, but I do the records myself and then lease them. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so if, you know, label infrastructure continues to kind of implode, would you go like the Bandcamp route and do something completely independent? I mean
I'm
kind
of doing it independently now.
Right,
really.
If you're just bringing it to
yeah.
them. So if there's no them to bring it to, like, would that be a route you would consider?
Yeah, I would just put it on Amazon, CD Baby, and, you know, hire a publicist.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, they hire the publicist, so it would just be on me, but it's pretty much what I'm, you know.
Yeah, it's every artist is an independent artist now, it
yeah.
seems like.
Yeah. Everyone, and no matter what job, pretty much is. And I always say, you know, when I was growing up, my mother was a school teacher, and my dad worked at Ford Motor Company. And she used to always say, you have to have your retirement set up, you have to have a pension, you have to have this, blah, 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 you know, and... Now I just say everybody's living the life of a jazz musician because mm-hmm. no one's job is secure.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting. Back in about 2006, I studied audio engineering at the New School and got, you know, certified and everything. And it was so fascinating to me to go into the studio and work, you know, because you had to do studio time as part of the coursework. And it was so fascinating to me to encounter engineers who came from the world where people, you know, they were basically like high priests, and artists would come to them and say, please help me make my record.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just not at all prepared for a world where they had to hustle for gigs.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know, it was really kind of fascinating to see the people that were in my, you know, group and, you know, younger than me coming in and saying, no, I'm just going to be, you know, freelancing forever. This is how life is now.
Yeah, unless you were someone like Joe Furler, where people were still seeking him out, you know. And I was lucky enough. Southern Comfort was his last record. That was his last session. But yeah, it's a very different world out here now for all of us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, studios, systems too, just, you know, said they're closing up.
Yeah,
you know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So you're... Your album covers and, you know, image in general is very sort of put together and artistically well done and stuff like that. And I was going to ask Tia about this as well, because her album covers are super glam.
Yeah, they're beautiful. But that's her. She's beautiful.
You feel like there's room for male jazz musicians to pay a little more attention when it's time to, like, do a photo shoot? Because I feel like some of these guys look like they were surprised at home by the photographer.
Anyway, we deal with that at the camp. We're talking I think women generally, we just, maybe it's the way we're raised, you know, you put yourself together before you step out of the house. But also, you know, as an African American coming up in our house, even my brothers, you didn't go out of the house unless you looked like you cared. And so, and there are some men. You look at people like Stefan Harris or Mark Carey, my brain is Javon Jackson, Donald Harrison. I can't even think. Mark Gross. Let's take Mark Gross, please. That's the cleanest man. He comes every day. He is clean. But that's who he is, you know. Mm-hmm. So on a gig, and that's what he expects of his band, you know. Those cats today, we went to hear them at the Newark Museum. They're all clean. It doesn't mean you have to come with a tie and a suit. You just have a flair, but look, the whole thing is look like you care. So I think, you know, what some of the people that, some of these guys maybe that don't care, they have to get the message from someone, is that people are listening to your music, but we hear with our eyes as well. We see first. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're in the store shopping, and, you know, I'm in the store and I'm looking at, you know, all the cereal, and if I don't know one cereal from the other, the way the box, the packaging is going to make me try one cereal over another. So we're products, and people have to understand. We've been talking about that with these young ladies this week. We're products. Our music is a product. So you have to present that. You can't just be about the music anymore. It's how do you present the music? How do you do a CD cover? What's going to make your cover, if you've got all these CDs, what makes your cover jump out? And, you know, some of the DJs from BGO were here last night and telling them, you know, color. You know, make the print so you don't have to put your reading glasses on to see it. Make it so that the titles are very clear. Who's on the tracks. Make it very, so you don't have to go searching for it. Mm-hmm. All of that is really important. You have to brand yourself. Tananya Jeffries was here talking about branding and social media today, and it was really amazing just to hear some simple things, even for myself. With social media, things that I just did not want to do or don't want to hear about. But it's like, well, if you're going to be out here and you want to stay out here and be successful, you have to do these things. Mm. And it's very much thought out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know some, you know, older artists who just don't want to deal with it, you know. I mean, I remember I had an interview once with McCoy Tyner, and I got about 5 minutes of questions, and then I just could feel the I don't want to do this anymore coming through the phone. You know, it's just like, he's just like, look, man. And I was like, all right, you know. And you just can't imagine a guy like that, you know, running a Twitter account. You
know? No, but that's why they have people out here to help you. You know, mm-hmm. I just, mm-hmm. even some of the young people here at the camper today, when I went to hear Mark perform, he had a string section with him. And I know the concert mistress, Kiara Fossey, she's like, I'll help you. So here you go. You know, plus she's more in touch with how this works. I feel like a dinosaur sometimes with this. And as Ms. Jeffries was saying this morning, you have to have a plan. You can't just go in and just, oh, here, I'm just gonna tweet this or put this on Facebook today and then not go on. Like, you have to really have a thought out plan.
Yeah.
And maybe you post something today or share it today, and it might be a month later. You share something else from that same thing. And just, she was talking about how people that have billions of followers, how it's all calculated.
Yeah, they have literally a calendar where it's like, okay, on Tuesdays we do this, on Thursdays we do this, you know, and every Saturday there's this.
I'm just trying to practice and get through the day. I can't think, but thank God there are people that do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like that, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the jazz world the last 2-3 years, obviously, about Kamasi Washington, mm-hmm. you know, and that is a guy who has his look together.
Right.
He's got his, you know, promo presence together. Like, he, you know, the music is solid, but then on the other side, he absolutely has a cohesive, you know, image.
Right.
And it's like, you look at the album cover, you look at the t-shirt, you look at, you know, everything, and he's the giant hair, the mm-hmm. the clothes, you know.
Right.
I mean, he looks like a guy from, like, Thundercats on his new album cover, you know, but it works.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like, you know, even with Tia, she's got that together. And she always does. It's not like this put-on thing where you just see, when you see her, she came by here to visit the other day and do a class with a girl. She looked beautiful. She walked in and she could have done a photo shoot for an album. Like, that's just, she knows that's part of, I think naturally she loves to dress, and who doesn't love to dress and look beautiful? But I think that's a natural, and when it's natural for you, you just kind of do it. And coming up in this age, it's really important. And, you know, we've been telling the young ladies here, you know, when you have a gig, your gig starts as soon as that front door opens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, tell me more about the program in general. Like, what have you guys been doing over the course of the week? And, you know, what kind of a range does the class, you know, does it all focus on? Because clearly it's not just about, you know, instrumental technique and, you know, learning to do arrangements and stuff like that. There, you are presenting like a whole picture of what it means to be a jazz musician in 2018, it sounds like.
Yes, I was trying. This is my first year. And I looked at a couple of schedules that the late Jerry Allen had put together, because I didn't want to come in and try and recreate the will. She'd already been doing such a fabulous job. So I kept a lot of that in place, but then I started to think, okay, business-wise, things that I didn't get when I was coming up, was great. She had in her schedule, they toured, they had a session with Sheila Anderson from BGO, and they toured Rutgers, the International Jazz Institute. So I wanted to bring even more business, and because they're of an age where they're dealing with social media, I brought in a couple of managers to talk to them about, you know, when do you need a manager, what is it that you need to look for, and just about handling your own business, you know. And they said to them, even before you hire a manager, you have a manager because you're your own manager, and how to kind of manage yourself until you can afford to get a manager. I brought in, today we had a session with Tananya Jeffries talking about branding and social media. So all these things, this is their world. This is so their world, and they need to understand that. And yes, while they're getting ensemble work and they're getting their technique classes, and they're having lessons with the faculty here, and they have such wonderful, loving, great teachers. And I've seen just from, it was interesting, on Monday they had their placements, and we didn't send out any music or any charts saying that. We just said they could come in and talk amongst themselves and choose a tune and play it. But when we said, okay, it's time to go up and do your auditions, you could see the look on their face. They were petrified, some of them. And I know when I hear that word, I'm petrified. So I try to say, okay, it's not an audition, it's just a place where you're just going to play. Some of them came in, there were a couple girls that had never improvised before in their lives. One girl on piano came in, she'd never played jazz. She played a classical piece for us by herself. Today, she's playing the chord changes to Equinox, Cantaloupe Island, and St. Thomas. I've watched them. I've been here late, sometimes walk around, I see them in their practice rooms, really practicing. You know, I go into the different ensembles and I see how much all of these women have grown in just a couple of days. But a lot of that comes, they're supporting each other, they're rooting each other. This moved me, it moved all of us. Placements, they come in, they play for us. When they leave, all the other ladies that were waiting to audition were out in the hall. Even when they finish their auditions, they stay there. Every single time the door opened and whoever was in doing their placement audition, all the women in the foyer clapped for every single one. That was heavy for all of us. It was really beautiful. So they've been rooting each other on all week. I saw two young girls in the practice room the other day, and the other one was like, you got this. No, you have to say, I can do this. So it was really encouraging for me to see that. They're really there for each other. The faculty really, they know how to pull what they need out of these young students, and they know how to really push them and encourage them. And you see how happy they are when they come out that they're playing. Their playing is so, I'm really moved by what's happened here this week. So far, we have two more days, mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
So do you think they're at all ready for the shark pool that is New York?
They're not ready yet. They're still young. They're still pretty much beginning. But if they want it, they're serious enough that they can have it, because they've shown this week that they're willing to put in the work. And if that's what they want, they'll do it.
Yeah.
And that's what's important, you know.
Are you passing on stuff to them that was not made available to you when you were, you know, a beginning jazz musician? I mean, I feel like there's a pool of knowledge that's being shared in the world of music generally that, you know, it was that, whether it's things that labels wouldn't tell you or that managers wouldn't tell you, you know, stuff like that. So, I mean, are you trying to kind of counteract that?
Well, I'm trying to arm them with information. We all are. And so, you know, no one told me, I didn't take a business course. So I remember, you know, the first time that I did a gig and didn't have a contract and I didn't get paid. So then I had to learn. And I joined the union when I was pretty young. And so, you know, I get the union contract, I had to start learning that. So I'm trying to arm them with information. And all of the instructors are doing that because we're all professional musicians and we've been out here for a long time. So they're all talking, you know, giving them bits of information here and there to help them. And the other day, Tia came in and did a really beautiful session with them, just talking about some of the issues that women face today. A lot of times these girls are the only girl in their jazz band. Or and some of their peers, how they treat them is really disrespectful, or some of their teachers, some of the staff, and sometimes they feel they don't know who to go to or they don't know what to do. So, you know, she just gave them so much information on how to handle some of that. And then some of the other faculty even, you know, is talking, sometimes you can't change other people, but you can change yourself. Mm-hmm. Or you can know in yourself, I'm doing what it is that I want to do. You know, I can't help it if you're threatened by me, but not to let those people discourage you or make you give up what it is you want to do. So, you know, I'm just trying to carry on Jerry Allen's legacy. This was such a beautiful program, and you know, I told the girls at the beginning, the first day that I met them, you know, in the spirit of excellence, we wanted to carry on in her name. So.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think broadly there's a financial barrier to entry for jazz? Is it, you know, because for example, I don't know if you're familiar with the thing in New York, or I think it might be nationwide, the Willie Mae Rock Camp for Girls. Are you familiar with this?
No.
It's a program, it's sort of similar to this, but it's rock focused, obviously. And what they do tuition-wise is they have run like a sliding scale so that parents can pay like little or nothing depending on their income. And then if you're, like, they have a literal chart on their website. They say if you make $100,000 a year or more in your family, then we're going to charge you double and apply it to some other kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I kind of feel like there's a, for lack of a better phrase, there's like a class element at work with jazz where, you know, it doesn't get presented to poor kids the way it gets presented to kids from, you know, from nice suburbs as an option in a way.
No, well, that's where this program is different, and it's here in Newark. Mm-hmm. There is financial aid available, you know, so that, and we make that known to kids so they can come. That's money is not going to be an issue. If they really want to do this, there's a way for it to be done, you know. Mm-hmm. and the camp will help. I think a lot of times what happens is in schools, you know, because they've taken music out of all the schools.
Yeah.
But in a lot of well-to-do neighborhoods, you know, those parents or those communities have gotten together and they fund a program for their community or for their school. In communities where that money is not available, you know, then a lot of times the kids in those communities, the opportunities are not there necessarily because the community doesn't have it. That's why you have something like this, NJPAC. You have this here to help those kids and anyone who wants to come here. So it's not just for, but I think it's when you see these young people that maybe wouldn't have had this opportunity, mm-hmm. if it weren't for an NJPAC, So the program is definitely available.
And I guess in a sort of a related question, I'm curious whether you think jazz has become too tightly bound to academics in general, like whether there's still room for somebody to just pick up a horn and go for it. Because I was recently in Norway in May, and they have the Trondheim University, it's a jazz program, which produces pretty much every Norwegian jazz musician that you've ever heard of. You know, like half of ECM Records comes from Trondheim, you know. And the musicians that I interviewed over there said, yeah, over here, you know, if you want to be a jazz musician, you come out of school to be a jazz musician, you know. And I feel like the best way of putting it, I guess, is the vernacular apprenticeship system where, you know, somebody joins an old drummer's band, you know, it's like a 60-year-old guy with a 20-year-old horn section, you know, that kind of apprenticeship system doesn't exist anymore. So where is that middle path, do you think?
Well, I think you're not going to get rid of academia. You know, that's just for jazz. That it is what it is. But you know, the beautiful thing when you have people in a program that are players, that's what's really important, that students end up with teachers that are actually living this music. Because you can't learn this stuff just from a book. We were laughing, I was talking to the piano instructor, Ellen Rowe, who also teaches at University of Michigan. And she was talking about when she was in school and her professor had taken this, I think it was a Coltrane or piece and was analyzing it. And she was taking all these notes, and then you see the pen, like just the red ink kind of dribble where she'd fallen asleep. And so, and that's not, when you take something so beautiful and you take it apart like that or dissect it like that, it's not music anymore. So, you know, these kids have an opportunity to work with people that are actually playing. They're teaching, but they're actually living the music and playing the music. So they have an upper hand because they're getting the best of both worlds. And I think that's really important because you can't learn this music just from a book. And you still have to do it. You can go through college and learn, but you still have to come out here and get on the bandstand. And that's when you really learn, is when you're on the bandstand with someone. Mm-hmm. So you can't bypass that.
Yeah. And I guess my last question is, in the past few years, I feel like there's a small group of jazz musicians, young guys mostly, who are reaching audiences that are more rooted in hip-hop and R&B and even like indie rock. So, you know, Kamasi or Christian Scott or Robert Glasper, you know, people like this. Do you think there's a generational divide building in the jazz audience? Like there are young people who listen to young performers that they've come across in, not by reading Downbeat, but by seeing them on Pitchfork or something, you know? And then what kind of path forward do you see regarding your own work in the 21st century?
Well, you know, the first person that comes to mind is Esperanza Spalding, mm-hmm. who's very young and just took the world by surprise, winning that Grammy, you know, mm-hmm. and just, which was wonderful. You know, but she's playing, you know, she's able to draw this very young audience because she's so young. But here she is playing with Wayne Shorter. So she's got these young people that are really interested in her. You know, they may come and say, oh, who's this Wayne Shorter? Who's Herbie Hancock? And Herbie Hancock, that's the perfect example of who has had a career through all the different stages of music and all the different, it's just music. And mm-hmm. so I think through these players, you know, they might hear Robert Glasper or Mark Carey. But that's always been the case. When you think about Dizzy, who incorporated all these different other styles of music and traveled and all these other influences into the music, that's the music just grows. And there are audiences for every type of music or every style. I think for me, because every record has been different, I never do the same kind of record. Mm-hmm. And my fan base as it is, at this point, I think they trust me. You know, it might be something that they scratch their head. You know, I remember when I first, when I did, was it Reverse Thread, and I came out with an accordion player. Some friends of mine were like, what is you? But people trust that it's not a gimmick, it's real. And, you know, my audience is probably middle-aged and older, but there are some young people, you know, I've been meeting, and they say, oh, we really like your music. So I think it's, you know, I think if as long as we're all honest and we're doing what it is that we love to do, people from all generations, you know, the people that are supposed to be there, we're going to touch those people. So, and I think it's beautiful when you have people that are the music that crosses all these different boundaries. That's what it's supposed to do. You know, that's what we as people need to do, reach across the aisle.
Okay, that was my interview with Regina Carter, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll support us at patreon.com/burningambulance and come back for the next one. Osiris.